Good morning, good morning, and good morning to you too. This is Law of the Land with Gloria J. Brown Marshall. This is a new year and a new start, a new time for us to begin again, to take into consideration all that we have in our lives, our communities, our country, and the world, be grateful for the blessings we have, and also decide we're going to take on a particular issue or concern, something we feel we can act upon to make our lives, our community, our country, better places for ourselves and, of course, the next generation. And I'm speaking of generations unseen, generations not known, people whose names we'll never know. That is so essential to progress that it cannot be just your child, your spouse, your partner, your friend, your loved one, your colleague. It has to be people in this world we'll never know, never meet. We have to trust and have the faith to believe that we can make a difference in our own ways, that we can go forward in our own ways and do what's necessary to make this world a better place. And with that, each one of us has a choice to make. The beginning of the year can be a beginning of a new exercise program, a new diet. It could be another New Year's resolution in which we all come together or individually decide how we're personally going to improve our lives. But I think we should make a New Year's resolution, a resolution that we will personally try to change the world in one small way. And we don't have to tell anyone. We don't have to make it known in our hearts. We keep that to ourselves, that we are going to make this world a better place by taking on something, whatever it may be. I want us to think about what happened in 2022. Many of the things that we still talk about today and others, like the coronavirus and the pandemic, the triple threat we have with RSV and the flu, and of course, the pandemic of corona, all those together, but at the same time, people acting as though it never happened until it happens to them. We also had Brittany Griner. We had her return and other people saying that it wasn't worth it. This was the first time in my life that I remember a Black person as the focus of the federal government's international struggles to bring someone home in this 21st century, as I said, the first time I recall it. Also, we had our U.S. Supreme Court giving us our Dobbs case overturning Roe versus Wade, and at the same time, the ascent of the first Black female U.S. Supreme Court justice, her ascendance to the highest court of this land, and her ability, as I've seen firsthand in person, while sitting in the U.S. Supreme Court, her ability to hold her own on the bench. We, of course, had the January 6th committee, and whether or not the January 6th committee's work will be held up in the new Congress, we'll soon see. But the Democrats still hold on to the Senate, and the Republicans holding on now, newly positioned, soon to be sworn in to control the House. We'll see what happens to the regular people, you and me, thrown in between all of us trying to make our way in the world. These people are our elected officials. They say they represent the American people. Well, I'm an American and I'm a person, but I rarely feel that the representation taking place is in my name, even though they use my name. I also want to make sure that we understand that Donald Trump refuses to go away. And this time he cannot, because the January 6th committee has decided, as they submit their work, and it is 1,000 pages, I've ordered the book of it myself, that They will send their work to the Justice Department with the names of the witnesses and all the information they have, with the hopes that Merrick Garland, our U.S. Attorney General, will press charges. We do know that Georgia, as well as right here in New York State, there continues to be criminal investigations and criminal trials against Donald Trump. Whether or not he's going to actually be the next president of the United States, which seems to be in his mind an escape from prosecution, because we don't know. We've never been in this territory of someone who will be a presidential candidate, and perhaps maybe based on the insanity of those who keep supporting this man, the next president of the United States, and whether or not he can then be hauled off to jail from the White House. We don't know any of these things as we go into our new year. We're going to have someone who can enlighten us soon as my guest, the now formidable District Attorney of Manhattan, Alvin Bragg, who will be discussing not just what he thought of his first year in office in 2022, but his plans for 2023. That will be the voice you hear as my guest on the other side of this musical break. This is Law of the Land, and as we know, Trump and his businesses are tangled in significant investigations. And right here, we have a new investigator who's been added to the Manhattan DA team. We'll ask about that. We'll ask about what DA Bragg has in mind for 2023 when it comes to gun violence, the opioid epidemic, as well as what his relationships will be when it comes to the other positions of power here, the state attorney general's office, as well as the city. All of that when we get back from this musical break.
Американская фирма Transceptor Technology приступила к производству компьютеров персональный спутник.
The power of our Manhattan DA right here on the phone. Good morning. Good morning, sir.
Good morning to you. How you doing?
I'm doing well, and I hear that you have not been doing so well lately.
No, I'm feeling fine. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Okay, if you don't mind that people know that they need to send their prayers out for a little bit of what's been going along with everybody else and a little bit of a COVID situation. But here we have I'm wrestling with RSV, just to let you know. But I thank you so much for being with us today. Here's my concern. We're starting this new year of 2023, and many people have said that 2022 was a rocky year for you. How do you see 2022?
We've really been talking about all the things that we built and worked towards in 2022. The fact that the encouraging sign at the end of the year that shootings and homicides were down citywide, but down even further in Manhattan, that our gun prosecutions are up and we're focusing on those who do the greatest harm. We're focusing on hate crimes, and our hate crime prosecutions are up. And we've put so much in place that we built that we're going to kind of see come to fruition in the next year. So we build an entire division called Pathways to Public Safety to focus on alternatives to incarceration. And we saw the beginning of that work last year with our referrals to felony HEI court and mental health court. So more work to do, certainly, but we think a good foundation that we're building and going to continue to be working to keep Manhattan safe and get additional safety through fairness and the other measures we put in place last year.
We had an opportunity to interview you when you were a candidate for this job. And what did you see from this side that you didn't expect when you were running for this office?
I had the great opportunity to spend, 20 plus years as a federal and state prosecutor and as a civil rights lawyer. And I think really had great preparation as a lawyer and a manager. Came into office, I think, during a time of almost a perfect storm, crime rising nationally, a gubernatorial campaign going on here, coming out of COVID and all the dislocations. And then obviously it was the first Black Manhattan district attorney. I was always taught, and my kind of mantra throughout my career is the work speaks for itself, focusing on victims and survivors and righting wrongs. And so I think, a significant lesson for me from particularly the first half of last year is that, in the macro sense of the position I'm in now, the work doesn't speak for itself, that a big part of it is, speaking to you, contextualizing the work, explaining to the public, in the micro sense for all of the, 500 assistant district attorneys who are great public servants in my office, the work does speak for itself in terms of, in the courtroom with the survivors, with the victims, with the witnesses. But a significant function of the job in my role is to contextualize all that, put that together, let people know, that shootings are down further in Manhattan, that homicides are down further in Manhattan. Let them know that our hate crime prosecutions are up as we're trying to meet the moment of some of the troubling things. Let them know that alternatives to incarceration, connecting people with mental health treatment in appropriate cases is a pathway to safety because it reduces recidivism. So I'll be doing more and more of that in the second year.
And I noticed that you have invested in a more user-friendly website and that you do have greater information on the website. But I also see that you have a website that includes almost like a political or politicians type structure where it has a donate button and, like you're still running for office. Is that a part of the strategy too, or is it just a strategy to inform and that just happens to be added to the website?
No, you may be looking at the old campaign website. The government website does not have a donate button, and that wouldn't be appropriate as someone who spent a career as a public corruption prosecutor and prosecuted people for campaign finance and other integrity issues. We certainly would not do that. So perhaps that's the old website that is somehow come up for you.
Okay. Going to the gun violence that you mentioned and that it's down, and I see on your stats that you state the gun violence is down. Is it that we just have the impression, do you think, that the media highlights gun violence cases more so on the victim side but not on the resolution side? Is that why we still, in the general public, feel unsafe when it comes to gun violence?
Gun violence is a significant issue. It is my number one priority. I believe it's the number one public safety challenge, certainly citywide, certainly in Manhattan. In my view, guns are traveling. So I would say I can speak for Manhattan. The number one thing is them coming in from other outside of the state, and then the fact that we've just got a number of unlawful weapons, on our streets here. So we have made significant progress in the numbers are trending in the right direction, and I think, very importantly, are further down percentage decline. If you look at the year from 2021 to 2022, further down in Manhattan. But there's make no mistake about it, there's more work to be done. We're going to keep on pressing ahead. You know, the things that we've been doing, we've been focusing on internal coordination in the office. We've been focused on coordinating with our state and federal partners literally every single day. People from my office sit around with people from the other four city district attorney's offices, federal law enforcement, federal, agents, and talk about the people who are driving gun violence in our city. So we're going to continue that. We're going to continue the gun trafficking. We'll continue ghost guns. We're going to continue looking at the intersection of domestic violence and guns. And so there are encouraging signs, but there's more work to be done.
And, sir, if you could give us just an idea, we hear the guns are entering New York City, even though we have the most stringent gun laws when it comes to restrictions. So what is the path? How are they coming in here? They're being driven in from the South, some people say. They're being flown in. And why is it that when we have arrests for gun violence or have arrests for gun possession, we never see the top dogs? We never see the guy at the top. We just see these street level kids for the most part and younger people who are involved with gun trafficking.
So I can tell you that we in our office, we had a couple of complex, wiretap investigations. The way those came, the guns in those cases came in were, by car and by bus primarily. Using the wiretaps so we can understand the structure of those who are bringing it in and trying to work our way to the tops of those organizations. And we had significant arrests and significant gun seizures in those cases. We've also seen people trying to evade our laws and in both those cases, the guns were coming from North Carolina. We've also seen people mailing ghost gun parts, for example, having them mailed to their homes in Manhattan. Or also to a neighboring state and then sort of bringing them in. So they're coming in a number of ways. We are working and we've done, a number of investigations last year and are continuing to focus on the people who drive the most violence and the people who, as you say, are responsible for the guns coming in. You put your finger on a very important issue, which is the use of the guns. And we are seeing younger people. Those cases are important too. We did an investigation with our federal counterparts, the U.S. Attorney's Office, of a very, very violent organized criminal enterprise that was committing robbery and attempted murders throughout Manhattan and the Bronx. We have to hold the end users of the guns accountable as well. They were doing significant violence in the street. So we're going to do both. We're going to continue to do both. The people who are committing violent acts in the streets of Manhattan and those that are connecting them with the guns, and I think we've got to do both. It's an and approach. It's all the above approach. I would also mention while we're talking about youth that we also want to be on the prevention side, not just the accountability side. So last year we did grants to 10 community-based organizations that were working directly with our young people who are affected by gun violence, providing them money during the summer months to do things like beautify an area that was marred by gun violence. That was a group in the fall that was still working and working on a mural, coming together and doing that art project and talking with the youth about the opportunity to sort of express, their thoughts and the impact of gun violence to them through art. So we're on that side as well. And another project I would mention is, as we investigate, we learn things. We learn about impacts on communities. And so what we've also been doing is with people, we conclude an investigation. If there's a set of people we've learned of that, there's no evidence to charge them, but we see that they're close to the fire, so to speak. We have connected, several young people with Cure Violence and Crisis Management when there was no evidence to charge them, but we don't want to see them in the next indictment. So those are the kind of things we've been doing, particularly to support our youth. And one last thing on gun violence that I would mention, an eye-popping statistic. In 2021, we have last year for full data, 97% of those shot at shooting incidents victims were black or Latino. and most of them male. So we've been focusing on the victims and the witnesses in those matter and the trauma they experience. And, you know, there'll be witnesses in our cases, and but we also want to be going beyond that and addressing the trauma. So we've got a great witness aid service group that focuses on victims, focuses on witnesses, and we formed a subgroup within that, our witness aid men of color. So they are able to connect with and reach out to victims of gun violence from a similar experience and with cultural competency. And we think that's going to help those victims and witnesses, and by extension, the trauma that's experienced by their loved ones.
I want to, in our moments here, speak to two other concerns before we go to Donald Trump. One, what is a ghost gun? And are these 3D printers and others something that you're concerned about? Because it seems that we hear this phrase ghost gun. And if you could quickly just tell us, what is that?
So a ghost gun is a non-serialized gun. So when you have a traditional gun, let's say like a handgun, you know, that people may have seen or seen on TV, it has a serial number. And one thing that we're able to do in part of our investigations, we track those serial numbers. We see where that gun came, what was the last lawful sale, who were the prior owners. We get a lot of intelligence. It helps us in tracking and doing investigations. Ghost guns are guns with no serial number. You mentioned 3D printers. They can be put together that way. We have, you know, some groups that are selling component parts, and then you kind of put them together on the in where the person then has a gun that has a bunch of parts that were sold, but then it's created a gun. That gun doesn't have a serial number. It is a significant, and that's a growing issue. We did a number of ghost gun cases last year. They are important, and I would say we still have to deal with traditional serialized guns. It's not like they've replaced those, but we're doing both. Again, it's an all-of-the-above approach on guns. They're all important because, you know, what we know is that if you are, you know, shot by a gun or you see a gun, you're not going to know whether it's a ghost gun or not. It's a gun. So all of our efforts on guns are important, ghost guns and traditional guns.
And these last two points, one of them dealing with housing and tenants. But first, I wanted to ask you about Donald Trump. You brought in a special prosecutor or a special attorney to work on this issue of Donald Trump and continue to use a great deal of the resources to prosecute him. What do you see in the future as far as the cases against Donald Trump coming from the city?
So, you know, we have an ongoing investigation, and so I'm constrained for what I can say because things like they could prejudice any case that we may or may not bring. But, you know, I think what is important and consequential is, you know, late last year we convicted the Trump Organization, really two corporations within the Trump Organization, of a, you know, decade plus long, you know, tax fraud scheme, and also the CFO for the organization pled guilty. So that was a very significant trial. The public got to see one, the rigor and professionalism of the team at the district attorney's office that is working on this matter. And two, they got to see the inner workings of the Trump Organization, and as I said, a decades-plus-long scheme. While that team was working in the public courtroom, which is how we traditionally speak, you know, there were other members of the team that were, you know, back in the office working behind the scenes, working on our ongoing investigation. Matthew Colangelo, who you mentioned, is a former colleague of mine. He and I both worked on the Trump Foundation matter, where we sued the Trump Foundation. We were at the New York Attorney General's office and held the Trump Foundation and put members of the Trump family accountable. He joined the district attorney's office, my office, last year, and he's going to, you know, work on a Trump-related matter, the broader investigation I spoke of. Importantly, he's also going to work on other things. He's a very talented lawyer. He's formerly at the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, where he did housing discrimination work. He's going to help us with our affordable housing initiative, where we're focusing on landlords who, we're investigating tenant harassment and, other things like lead paint and things like that. He's going to help with those efforts. And formerly, he was the chief of staff at the U.S. Department of Labor to then Secretary Tom Perez. So he comes with deep experience in worker protection issues. He's going to be focusing on those. So, yes, we got the ongoing Trump organization. They're going to be sentencing in a couple of weeks. That matter, we've got the broader Trump-related investigation. But we've got a lot of other matters going on in the white-collar space, standing up for workers and tenants. Matthew's going to be involved in all that work.
And you mentioned the housing and tenants, so I'm not going to go as deeply into that with our last moments, but I do want people to know that there is a more effort and attention being placed on the DA's office on housing, which is a very important issue. But it also touches on what we're seeing now, which is the city's move to forcibly hospitalize or in taking homeless people or the unhoused off of the street. What role do you see your office playing in that?
So I think you're referring to the mayoral initiative. We this is something I've worked on a long time in various professional capacities. And we have a separate initiative that we were working on for a long time that we announced a request for proposals that we invited the community-based and our voluntary programs. And we're going to put navigators, people who come from community-based organizations, know neighborhoods. We're going to put them in up to six Manhattan neighborhoods, and their role will be to connect with people in distress on a voluntary basis. We've all seen it coming out of dislocations of the pandemic. Someone who may be talking to him or herself, someone who may be walking around partially clothed and it's cold weather. The navigators will be trained in this, are going to be approaching them to build trust. Maybe that they buy them a cup of coffee when they first see them, and maybe that they it's a warm glove to connect with them, to find out what their needs are, build trust, and to connect them with services. So we did a $9 million request for proposal, two proposals, and one piece is that community navigators. The other one is very similar, but will be based in the court. So that's what we're doing at the Manhattan District Attorney's Office. I see mental health, all last year, if you looked in, on one of the courtrooms in Manhattan, and really, particularly during the pandemic, you see the manifestations of, a healthcare system, with, I think we all agree, that has gaps and is porous. And then, as I was beginning to say, this is something for me that's been something that I've been thinking about for some time. When I was growing up, my dad worked for the city and helped run homeless shelters. So I had a lot of interaction with unhoused population, and our initiative is a way to connect with them and to reduce recidivism for those who are justice involved and those who are not justice involved, to meet them where they are and so that they do not end up in the system.
And before you leave, we discussed before on this show many times the immunity that prosecutors have. And in your interview going into this position, you said you would take another look at the behaviors of prosecutors. Is there reform, any changes when it comes to the immunities prosecutors hold? And what do we as the regular people have to look forward to when it comes to the blanket immunity and how those bad prosecutors in the world, not necessarily in your office, but if they are, how their behaviors can be addressed?
Right. So the immunity issue applies to sort of civil relief that others could bring. For us, we have police accountability unit, which is focused primarily, as the name suggests, on police misconduct. When I was at the attorney general's office doing that kind of work, we did prosecute a city district attorney. So certainly I have a history in giving this issue primacy. We also have a post-conviction justice unit, which is looking back and looking at cases And, you know, part of that may be ineffective assistance by defense counsel. Part of it may be error by a prosecutor. So we're examining that, you know, the information on our website if people want to bring a case to our attention. You know, system accountability is fundamental to public safety. I know, you know, myself as someone who's, you know, experienced some issues with accountability from system actors, the effect that it has on trust and the fact that it has on people who are willing to come forward. And we need victims and witnesses to have, you know, trust in us and come forward. One example involving, you know, police officers, not lawyers, you know, late last year, we, you know, had almost 200 convictions voided where the convictions were the result of officers who've engaged in significant, you know, misconduct, and in many instances been convicted, and then these arrests were ones that they've been substantially involved in. So this kind of system accountability is key. Our post-conviction justice unit, our police accountability unit, they're reporting directly to me. It's something that we know is important for the fairness of the system, and as I said, ultimately for public safety. If people don't trust us, they don't come forward as victims and witnesses, and we can't hold accountable and get the public safety we all deserve.
And I want to applaud you on creating and giving more focus to victims. I see your office is doing that now.
It's critically important. I think it's something that is not sufficiently part of the public dialogue. You know, the work we do, you know, when I came into the office, was very pleased to see the work of the Witness Aid Services Unit. Phenomenal group of counselors, advocates, clinicians, and the work they do side by side with, you know, survivors of domestic violence and human trafficking. The group I mentioned that's working with you know, gun victims and survivors. This is work that, you know, yes, is connected to our cases and that they are, you know, witnesses or victims, but their work can extend beyond the case. They're staying in touch with people after that because we're concerned about the well-being and health of people beyond the life of the case. All the services are free of charge, you know, a dedicated, very, very talented group. And so that is key. When we're talking about public safety, we need to really always keep in mind the people who, and I would all crime, but in particular, the survivors and victims of violent crime.
We thank you so much, sir. And as you leave us, are you guided by a particular legal or personal philosophy as district attorney? You're one of, if not the most powerful district attorney in the country. Is there a legal or personal philosophy that you have that is guiding you and thus using your influence to guide other DAs across the country?
Public safety, you know, is our, you know, sort of guiding star, you know, doing everything with that in mind. First, you know, focusing on violent crimes. You know, second, kind of everyday New Yorkers and cases involving kind of power asymmetries, you know, whether that's our tenants, our workers, you know, a public integrity matter where the taxpayers are being defrauded, you know. And then the last, you know, piece that we just talked about is, you know, achieving safety through fairness, holding the system accountable, giving mental health a primacy, you know, using alternatives to incarceration we can. So all of that work is public safety work, and that's the guiding light.
Well, we thank you, and we hope you can come back. We want to, if we can in the near future, have you come back and talk to us about the relationship between the DA's office and the NYPD. I think that by itself is a full conversation, and we look forward to the time we can have that conversation with you. Thank you so much, sir.
Thank you so much for having me on. Look forward to talking soon.
Okay. This is Law of the Land with Gloria J. Brown Marshall. That was our man in power, the DA of Manhattan, Alvin Bragg, who is considered, that office, the most powerful DA in the country. He had a conversation with us about 2022 and what he sees going forward in 2023. And we hope that We'll have that conversation coming up. He had a hard stop for this one, but we can in the near future talk with him again about NYPD. We think that that, of course, is crucial, especially given the fact that the prosecutor's office and the police department work hand in glove throughout the year and develop these relationships that sometimes leave the general public believing that their relationship is more important than the relationship that we have with them. We had this year so many things that happened, including the war against Ukraine. And together, we're still here for another year. And together, we can help each other. We can be stronger. We can be better. We can help those around us. All of this, I think we can do. I can see it. I really can see it. I think I have the best listeners in the world, and I look forward to another year with you. And in all of this, I always say, I'll see you on the radio.